And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It's a Wednesday, February the 28th, 2018. Last day of February 2018. Can you believe that? Will February go out like a lion? Will March come in like a lion, go out like a lamb? Or I guess it will February go out like a lamb? It's kind of going out like a lamb today. Not too bad here today, but how will March come in? Will we have a cold March or a warm March? We'll find out as time goes on. 15 minutes past the hour, and today we have one of our favorite guests on. She is a reporter, writer for the Daily Beast Online, and you can now catch her again on the McLaughlin Group, which was relaunched back in January. If it's not on in your area, ask for it, and until you get it, go online, search McLaughlin Group, and you will see the new programs, and you'll get to see our guest. I watched an episode last night on gun control, which was highly fascinating, as the McLaughlin Group always was. We welcome one of my favorite guests, Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
Glad to be with you, Scott. Thanks for the plug for the group. Appreciate it.
You know, Eleanor, I was thinking this as I was watching it last night. You and Pat are the longtime a panelist on that show, and you argue like crazy on there. What is your relationship with Pat Buchanan?
I consider him a friend. He also, when he's not spinning for his side of the political aisle, he's a very smart analyst, and he's been so much a part of our politics. I mean, he can always come up with a story from the Nixon days. And on last week's show, in addition to the gun issue, he recalled how actually Nixon altered his position on guns, moderated them, and there was absolutely no blowback at all. That was probably after the assassinations of King, Martin Luther King Jr., and Bobby Kennedy. And people changed, and legislation got through. It wasn't easy, but it happened. And then we discussed the passing of Billy Graham, and Pat said, you know, there were two people during that era who could fill Yankee Stadium on 24 hours notice. He said Billy Graham was one of them, and then he turned to the rest of us off camera and said, who was the other one? And we all looked at him blankly, and he said Malcolm X. Only Pat Buchanan would know that little detail. I do appreciate his political knowledge. And when we disagree, it's generally a civil, friendly agreement. And I think on guns, I think he is truly disturbed as anybody would be by the carnage that we've seen. But he holds fast, like so many of his generation, and his commitment to the NRA holds fast to that position that he's always held.
You know, I have heard people say that Buchanan was Trump before Trump was. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I definitely do. And if you put that into the Daily Beast, I actually wrote a column along those lines at least twice. they actually ran against each other in 2000. For the Reform Party nomination, which was the leftover party from Ross Perot. And that's when Trump called himself an independent for a brief while. And he thought he could just make a few speeches and he would get that nomination in the year 2000. He didn't really want to bother with organizing, which Pat did, and Pat is very good at. And so Pat actually won the nomination that year, and that was the year that we went into the protracted counting after the election. I think it was 36 days before they finally decided that George W. Bush, the Supreme Court decided that George W. Bush was the winner. But there was a controversy over ballots that were cast in Florida, where a number of voters in Palm Beach County thought they were voting for Ralph Nader and ended up voting for Pat Buchanan. And that was one of the issues of that election. So that was 2000. But on immigration and trade, certainly Pat held positions that Trump holds today, and Pat held them, you know, 20 years ago.
Want to talk a little bit about the gun discussion, because it's certainly taken over our country at this point. Do you think the CNN town hall? Do you think the discussion, do you think the headlines and the students are finally going to cause some kind of a change?
Yes, I think they already have. Dick's Sporting Goods, major chain that carries guns, said they're not going to sell to anyone under age 21, and they believe they're not going to stock the AR-15s anymore. That's huge. And you do see politicians moving on what are really minor corrections to the law, but we've been in such a stalemate for so long, I'll take whatever they're willing to do. And it's unclear whether Congress will be able to, in the end, pass anything, because I think the Democrats see this as a moment of leverage, and they want to get universal background checks, because 40% of guns are sold at these gun shows, and nobody does any checking. And that would be a major loophole to close, and Republicans are resisting. Now, if the Democrats try to attach that, that could be the poison pill that sinks everything. But you see movement on the states. You see Rick Scott, Florida governor, who wants to run for the Senate, is saying he's ready to sign a $500 million package to improve school safety. I understand the Florida legislature also included $26 million to train teachers to carry arms. And Scott has said he's opposed to that, so I don't know whether he doesn't sign that part or how that plays out. But the gun issue has become much more of a political issue, in the sense that there's passion now on both sides. And these kids who have entered the debate, you know, they're going to be voting in the next election, and they will enter the political season as one issue voters. And typically, how you vote as a young person stays with you for a good long time. So I think the Republicans are really risking losing a whole generation of kids over guns, and also their opposition to same-sex marriage, which is also puts them on the other side of where most young people are.
I'll tell you, it certainly has impacted here in Ohio with our big governor's race coming up, and our sitting governor, who I think we all believe at this point is going to run for president, because we have Dennis Kucinich, who's running second in the Democratic primary. Now, his stance is ban assault weapons in Ohio. Cordray, who's leading, now he's kind of in the middle. He's saying, well, I think we should have sensible gun laws, but he hasn't set up an assault weapon ban. On the Democratic side, the leader, DeWine, says, now he doesn't think we need bump stocks. He's for outlawing those. And then our lieutenant governor, who's losing on the Republican side, says no change at all. It's mental health. And the quagmire is, you have a Republican governor who's there until January, who might run for president, who is saying he believes now in sensible gun laws and possibly might sign an assault weapons ban. So he's more in line with the Democrats.
Well, did he say he might possibly sign an assault weapons ban? Is that making its way through the legislature? Is that a possibility?
He has said that. He said that right after the tragedy. I don't know if he'll do it or not, but it's certainly risky for a Republican, as you say, but maybe it's what you said. He wants to run for president, and he doesn't want to be the Republican that loses a generation of voters.
Right, and you don't want to be the Republican who looks like he's hooked into the NRA, led by the nose by the NRA. Dangerous position. Now, it's my understanding, though, that Dennis Kucinich found in Cordray's background that when he was Attorney General, that he fought against an assault weapons ban in Ohio, successfully fought against it.
Well, what?
And I think.
Yeah,
I think he's using that against Cordray in the primary.
It's a little murky, because Cordray was Attorney General in 2010 when this went down, and it was going to be left up to the cities. Do you want it? Do you not want it? And he did not allow that. He said, whatever way the state goes, we shall go. And Kucinich is beating him above the head with that now. And their first debate's next week. And I don't know, Kucinich, with all this tragedy, if Cordray doesn't explain what sensible gun laws mean, he might pull ahead. The debate's next Wednesday. It'll be interesting.
Yes, I was going to say that the gun debate has real power behind it right now. Maybe that will fade by November, but in time for these primaries, I think it's a visceral issue. Cordray generally is a very cautious individual, and Kucinich can be quite fiery in debate. So I'm sure he'll bring all the passion he feels and can muster to that issue in the debate. Who is sponsoring the debate in Ohio?
I believe it's the Democratic, because we had David Pepper on yesterday, who's the head of the Democratic Party. I believe it's the Democratic Party. WTOL is airing the debate.
Okay.
But I do know, Kasich said this week that he would not sign a Stand Your Ground bill, which I think is in the legislature in Ohio.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. The Stand Your Ground, I mean, Florida kind of pioneered that, and that was, of course, involved in the Trayvon Martin case. And that's a piece of legislation that was produced by ALEC, which is the acronym for Legislative Exchange Group that's very Republican. And they draft these laws, and they hand them out to Republican legislatures around the country, and they've had a great deal of success getting them passed, and Stand Your Ground is one of them.
Well, I think Kasich's quote, which I think, you know, people need to hear, is he said, if you're a strong Second Amendment person, you need to slow down and take a look at reasonable things that can be done to answer these young people. So that, from a Republican governor, that's very mild.
Right, exactly.
None of them want his nobody wants his endorsement. They've all, none
nobody.
Of them.
But he's very popular. He's very popular in Ohio, isn't he, Kasich?
He won 86 of 88 counties in his last election, and he endorsed his lieutenant governor. She said she didn't want the endorsement, and DeWine certainly isn't clamoring for it. So I don't get it.
Well, it's the primary voters. That's when the Trump faction of the party shows up in numbers, and they don't want to alienate those voters. That's my guess.
It could be, but I think in the main, that's going to benefit the Democrats in the end, because I think they've run away from it too much in the press. It's going to be hard to go back on that with 5 months to go.
I agree.
Very difficult. They've got two. Kucinich and Cordray, I think, are fairly good candidates. Been a long time since a really good candidate ran for governor in Ohio. On the Democrat side.
On the Democratic side, right.
Yeah.
No, these are two people with strong brands and significant followings.
What is going on with Jared Kushner? It was one of the big three stories yesterday. He gets downgraded security clearance. What is the issue with him?
Well, he's been operating with an interim security clearance for over a year, which is highly unusual for someone who's considered a top official who's dealing with a lot of foreign powers. And it has basically been suggested in news reports that are very well sourced that he was never going to get a security clearance because of his complicated financial entanglements. The Washington Post reported today that intercepts that they obviously saw conducted by U.S. intelligence agencies had identified four countries where the leaders were heard discussing how they could leverage Kushner's complicated financial life and his family's huge debt to get what they want out of the administration, and add that to his naivete on foreign policy issues. He was seen as being a target of foreign influence, and the four countries were identified as China, the United Emirates, Israel, and Mexico. And apparently the whole discussion over whether he should have access to the daily intelligence briefings and other highly classified material, was of concern within the White House by General Kelly, the Chief of Staff, and H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor. And so they basically recommended that he get a reduced clearance. Now, how the president responds to this is anybody's guess. I mean, I'm thinking that both Kelly and McMaster may have just written their epitaph as White House aides, that he might want to get rid of them over this issue, or the president could exercise the power that he has as the chief executive to waive the concerns about his son-in-law's security issues and just grant him clearance. He's able to do that, but has so far refused to do that. And isn't another possibility that, you know, Jared and Kushner and his wife, Ivanka Trump, you know, might decide to just go back to New York. Apparently their spokesman has decided to go back to the private sector in New York. And Kushner may just regard this as a demotion that he doesn't want to live with. And his family does have very daunting financial issues. They own this iconic property in New York, 666 Fifth Avenue. I think it was once the home of Revlon, if I remember correctly. And their debt on that building, I read, is $1.2 billion. And it comes due, like, next year. So there's not so many strands in this as to whether Kushner survives, whether Kelly and McMaster get to be the sacrificial lambs, whether the president is truly so reliant on Jared Kushner that he cannot tolerate losing him, or whether he says bye-bye and sends the son-in-law packing. Trump is such a mercurial personality, it's really hard to understand how he will navigate all of this. He has not tweeted about it, I don't think. The last tweet that he did that I'm familiar with was when Hope Hicks, his longest-serving aide now, this 29-year-old woman, she testified behind closed doors to the House Intelligence Committee, and the morning she was to do that, he tweeted just two words, witch hunt, maybe it's even one word, in capitals. And she apparently told the House committee members that she had told some white lies as a Trump spokesperson, but she would not elaborate on anything that has happened since she became part of the administration. And the committee did not push her because the committee chair is Devin Nunes, who Republican, who is very eager to protect the Trump White House. So that's where that stands. But I think a lot of people's personal lives are kind of up in the air now.
I would say so. I want to double back here to Ohio just for a second before we head back to Washington, just so I have this right. 10 days ago, Governor Kasich was quoted as saying, there's got to be something done about the goddarn AR-15. 2 days later, Democratic state lawmakers offered him one. It's a proposed ban on assault weapons, including the type of gun that was used in Florida to kill 17 students. The language in the bill could effectively ban all semi-automatic weapons. Kasich did vote in 94 and 2004 while he was in Congress, for the bans that were placed on assault weapons, and he's saying right now that he is consulting with both sides before he decides if he's going to sign this or not. What's your bet, Eleanor? You think he's going to sign the ban or not?
Okay. Is that going to be presented to him by the legislature, by a Republican legislature?
It was presented by a Democrat, Senator Michael Skindell, a Democrat from Lakewood and a Democrat from Columbus, Carletta Tavers have presented it to him, and he says he's got to think it over.
But doesn't it have to go through the legislative process?
Well, I think
that's the part I don't.
Yeah. Well,
can he? You know, would this be an executive ban?
I think that's the idea. What they're trying to get done to get him to because of
right.
And he's not saying.
I think he's going to avoid taking that direct a stance because if he has political ambitions, he would presumably still be in a Republican primary, and again, that's where more of the pro gun rights people would be. So I'm convinced he has presidential ambitions. So I'm sure there's probably what he would like to do maybe in his heart, and then he's kind of weighing it against whether he should close off all options by taking one side or the other. I think, you know, it's an issue that Democrats have faced. I mean, Democrats have not been out front on the gun issue because they have members who and lawmakers in red states, and if you go too far out on the gun safety side, you lose those active people on the other side. Now, maybe if they're not gettable in the first place, you don't have to worry about them. But if you're somebody like Kasich who wants to get a bigger tent, I think he's going to be careful about alienating one side or the other. I mean, politicians love to kind of walk a middle line, but maybe we've gone past the time for middle lines. Maybe the time for real determined leadership might be the better card to play politically. I'm sure he's having those discussions.
What has astonished me as a governor who's only going to be in office for 11 more months, I thought he would avoid that like the plague, the issue, but he didn't. I mean, he said, we got to do something about these things. Whether or not he signs the legislation or not are two different things, but taking it on, I thought, could hurt him raising money on a Republican primary.
Huh. Well, yeah, a Republican primary, we're talking, I mean, if he decides to challenge, if Trump is the candidate in 2020, and Trump hired his campaign manager for 2020, identified him, and then he would have to run in a Republican primary against Trump. And depending on what Trump's standing in the party is at that point, it could be a crowded primary, or Kasich could be the one and only. And Kasich is someone, I mean, you know him better than I do, but he's an emotional guy. I mean, he will say things that he then maybe has to walk back or he has to defend, but he'll blurt out on occasion what he really thinks. And I think that's what we saw with his comments on these deadly weapons. I mean, he's got two teenage daughters, and I think this younger generation is really, you know, showing their parents that they don't want to live with the threat of gunfire hanging over them every day as they go to school. And these are the same young people that really had an impact on the debate over same-sex marriage, moving their parents along more quickly on that issue than anyone could have imagined. So I think anybody who has teenagers is going to have an awfully hard time defending assault rifles.
Before we leave Kasich, because I think this is an interesting subject, something that really I heard, and it didn't get a whole lot of play at the time, that I thought was very interesting. After the last election, presidential, John Kasich, Governor Kasich, said that he had been on Fox News, he had been governor in a popular state, he had won his governor election 86 out of 88 counties, and yet nobody in New Hampshire knew who he was. And now he's on the news all the time, and now he wrote a book, and now he even said something the other day about an independent. He thinks the time for two-party systems might be over. I don't know. If he doesn't run, he's
echoing what a lot of people are saying. Went to actually two events here in Washington in the last couple of days. One by a group called America Unite, and they're fielding, or they're actually endorsing and supporting a slate of five candidates running as independents. And the one name you would recognize probably is Greg Orman. He ran as an independent in 2014 in Kansas against sitting Senator Pat Roberts, and it was a race that got a lot of attention because Roberts had to confess that he'd been in Washington so long he really didn't have a residence anymore in Kansas, that he used a, quote, recliner at a friend's house, and it turned out his wife is a real estate agent in Virginia who claims that she's been a Virginia resident for more than 20 years, so that didn't play well back home in Kansas. And they went into the election day tied in the polls. And a lot of the pundit coverage was, you know, the day has come for independent candidates and all of that. Well, Greg Orman, who's a mostly self-funded businessman, lost by 10 points. And there are probably lots of reasons why that happened. But he's now running for governor of Kansas as an independent. And the likely Republican candidate is probably going to be Kris Kovach, who is the Republican who led that Citizens Commission to look into voter fraud, which was disbanded, didn't really find any voter fraud. So you have Greg Orban, and then you have the only independent governor in the country. Do you know who that is?
Independent governor.
An Alaska governor,
oh.
Bill Walker. And so he's on the slate. He's running for re-election. And then you have a woman who's an independent state treasurer in Maine who's running for governor. And governor likes independence. I mean, Maine likes independence. And so she's there. And then they have two Senate candidates, one a businessman in Missouri, and then another businessman in Maryland. I think both of them are extreme long shots. But there's a lot of interest, especially among young people, in independence and just looking for another choice beyond what is very disparagingly called the duopoly. So,
You know, Eleanor, I'll tell you something interesting is, and I'm going to, next time Representative Kucinich is on the show, I'm going to ask him about this. There was a meeting in Aspen last September with Dennis Kucinich, mm-hmm. Ron Paul, and Jesse Ventura. They won't say what they talked about, but Jesse Ventura, independent governor from Minnesota, was the independent governor. Kucinich, who now is running for governor of Ohio, he's running as a Democrat, but he is running at 70-something years mm-hmm. old. And Ron Paul certainly is not gone. So I don't know what that conversation was, but mm-hmm. Independent...
It would be better if it were Rand Paul instead of Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And the thing is that Ron Paul had some success, brief, but that's over, and Ventura had some success, brief, and that's over. So it's hard to see them making comebacks, but the principles that they support and the aura of independence, they'd be great speakers, you know, for groups trying to get some momentum behind independence. The other group that met was one called Protect Democracy, which is created by or formed by a former Obama lawyer, and then Stand Up Ideas, which is Evan McMullen's group. He ran as an independent for president last time around, and their goal is basically to not necessarily to endorse or project the candidates, but to look at the ways that American democracy has been assaulted and undermined by the Trump presidency, and to kind of look where where we go after Trump is gone. So I thought that was interesting, you know, looking post-Trump when he's just a little over a year into his term.
I've always thought one of the main problems was with the independent candidate, whether it was Ross Perot or Nader or Buchanan or whoever was running on a third-party ticket, was that there's not a whole lot of good surrogates to go out. But if you had people like Jesse Ventura and Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich, who've been on television and who could go out and surrogate for you, that might be worth something. And I'll tell you something that I found interesting yesterday when I was asking the head of the Democratic Party here in Ohio about the debate. They haven't endorsed anybody. The Republican Party's already endorsed DeWine, even though the primary's not happened yet. The Democratic Party has not endorsed anybody yet. And I said, well, when it comes to surrogate time in the main, of course you'd welcome President Obama. Of course you'd welcome Joe Biden. Yeah, yeah. I said, well, what about Hillary? In the women's movement, she's got a super PAC, I hear. She's not going to run for president again. Would you welcome her? Yeah, we would, but I don't think she'd come. Well, what is this super PAC for?
Right. Well, super PAC is also to funnel money to candidates that she would support. Not necessarily meaning that she would show up. The Clintons have always been pretty realistic about where they're welcome and where they're not, and I think that's true of Obama as well. I must say, Hillary, after a number of appearances in last year, you don't hear that much from her as we head into primary season here. I think she's great for raising money with certain groups, but the energy in the Democratic Party now, which is actually sparked by Trump's victory and her defeat, but it's mostly on the more progressive side. And while I think it's really unfair to say Hillary's not a progressive, she is, and she was there on a lot of those issues before her critics were born, but she's not identified with that wing of the party. And so, I mean, I look at what happened in California with Dianne Feinstein and not getting the endorsement of her party, because there's a credible challenger, and he's Hispanic, and he's young, and he's the head of the state Senate, and a lot of people think, his time has come, or their time has come. So you do have these strains within the Democratic Party, and the Clintons kind of take the brunt of that, the Clintonism is over, they should leave the scene, that sort of thing, I think. And so I think they're going to be mindful of that in deciding where they go and where they can be helpful.
What is curious about me to her is that I always thought the reason she didn't take a lot of things and didn't do a lot of things was because she was always planning a run, and because she was always in a position like Secretary of State or Senator that she really wanted to make change. And I don't think she'll ever run for anything again, but what is fascinating to me is when she no longer has to be guarded, this is the time when we see her the least. I thought she might take a job on television. I thought Bill Clinton was going to for a while until Hillary decided to run.
It's such an easy phrase, but too much baggage. And you don't have on the liberal side in media outlets willing to take you in, no matter what you've done, because you're wearing their shirt. Fox is taking in all kinds of people, without question. Former politicians, I just don't see that happening on the Democratic side.
Eleanor, something yesterday that I saw, or last week, Eleanor Roosevelt on What's My Line. Now, this is after the presidency. But you wouldn't see Hillary Clinton on Let's Make a Deal Today or Michelle Obama. It's a whole
right.
different.
Hold on. I'm The Apprentice.
Oh, boy.
Right. Yeah. But, looking back on the campaign, Trump made himself available a lot of the cable shows, and they would let him call in and everything. And Hillary was very parsimonious about where she would appear. And that added to this notion that she was so cautious, she was so careful, she must be hiding something. Because Trump won, although I know she did win the popular vote, his style of talking to his voters and revving up his voters worked, whereas hers didn't. And I agree with you that when she lets her hair down and comes across as not so guarded and more authentic, she connects so much better. But she never could learn that lesson in real time. She always learned it after the fact. Al Gore was another victim of that. He was so cosseted with concerns about getting every talking point correct and not making a mistake that he, you know, made there were more self-inflicted wounds than if you just kind of, you know, went with who you are. People want to know that they're getting the real deal. And I, you know, so many people, and women especially, who I know and respect would say, you know, I just don't trust Hillary. And I would think, God, you're just picking that up out of the talking points. Did you listen to Fox? But she managed to evoke that response in far too many people that the real Hillary wasn't out there on the stump, that she was somehow hiding who she really was and that you couldn't trust her. And that's why that whole email thing, which I think was mostly a fiasco, but why it was able to take off to the extent it did, Trump and his people hammered it relentlessly, and the media went along with it. And there was that, you know, kernel of truth there that Hillary didn't want us to see her emails. that turned out to be, you know, her self-destruction.
In the last 10 minutes here, I want to come to President Trump, because since we've talked last, we've had 13 indictments of 13 Russian indictments. We have had three companies in Russia indicted. We now know that they did interfere, and they wanted President Trump. They did not want Hillary Clinton. We know some things that they did. Gates has now taken a plea deal with Mueller, right along with Flynn and Papadopoulos. And the investigation's not over. And Trump is not sanctioning Russia yet for trying to stop them from interfering in the 2018 elections. Why is he not sanctioning them? He has to know that looks bad. And what more could there be?
Well, Sarah Sanders was out there arguing that President Trump has been tougher on the Russians in his 1 year in office than Obama was in 8 years. They say all these things that have no basis in fact. But why he has been so wary of offending the Russians is something that I hope we will know once Bob Mueller completes his probe. Where it goes next, Mueller is a careful prosecutor. He's putting together a case methodically. I think there's more to come. Paul Manafort is facing the rest of his life in jail if he doesn't cooperate or if he doesn't get a pardon. And there was a compelling article in Atlantic Magazine by Franklin Foer, F-O-E-R, which tells you more than you want to know about Paul Manafort. But what jumped out at me in 2015, he had a nervous breakdown, and he was in a facility in Arizona, and emails between him and his daughter suggest the depth of his despair and that he'd considered suicide and huge financial problems. Okay, he reemerges in 2016 and takes a job with the Trump campaign. I think he was gone. I forget the timeline. Did he sign on in August or did he leave in August? But he signs on with the Trump campaign when nobody thought the Trump campaign was going to be successful. He does it for no money. All right, he's working for this alleged billionaire, and he's accepting no money. But why would he do that when you consider the huge financial problems he was facing? Well, you know, looks to me like there were contacts that he knew he could make. And if those contacts with various oligarchs, if Trump in any way was in on it or was informed or whatever, I mean, that could be big trouble for President Trump. And it seems to me that Manafort is telegraphing every way he can that he's trying to hold fast, and he's sorry that his partner, Rick Gates, chose to do otherwise for reasons Manafort put in a statement as yet disclosed. So seems to me that Gates couldn't sustain the pressure and the financial pressure by continuing to maintain his innocence. He's got three young kids. He's in his late 40s, I think. So he decided to make a deal. And presumably, he's got information that will incriminate Manafort. And we're assuming that Manafort has information that could potentially incriminate the president. And that seems to me the path that Mueller is following.
If that is true, now that Gates has pleaded, we know that. Now, why? What would stop Manafort from pleading now?
Even if Manafort pled guilty, I will now cooperate with you.
Because if Gates has the goods on him, and he's not willing to spill them on Trump, then the only person who gets squeezed here is Manafort.
Right, exactly.
So why wouldn't he plea?
I don't know what Manafort's breaking point is, and whether he's holding out. He could be holding out for a pardon. I don't know.
Would the Republicans put up with that in Congress if Trump pardoned Manafort?
A lot of them believe it's all a witch hunt, and they'll say even if it's about money, it's about money long before he became president. So, you know, it's crossed a red line. The Republicans have put up with a lot so far, and they're going to be holding their fingers to the wind and looking at how the public reacts. If the public sort of reacts with a collective shrug, oh, it's just a bunch of lawyering, doesn't mean anything, it's, you know, the FBI is corrupt. I mean, the administration has tried very hard to lay the groundwork to discredit whatever Mueller comes up with. I mean, I'd like to believe that this is still a fact-based universe, and if the special counsel really does have the goods on President Trump, and if he really did, you know, leverage U.S. prestige and the prestige of his presidency for financial reasons, you know, that he should be held accountable. We'll see.
What if the dossier is true and it's just plain blackmail by Russia? How would the country see that?
Right. Much of the dossier is true. What has not been approved is the sort of the scurrilous parts. And it's not that hard to imagine that there might be a tape out there of some kind. And that's what Trump is resisting coming out. You know, I don't know. Then do we just say, okay, He's our president, and he was put in this compromising position, but he hasn't done anything to betray this country. Depends again what Mueller comes up with, and we don't know.
You know what's always been interesting to me, because everywhere I turn, and I even see John Dean now a lot on CNN. Between Nixon and Trump. And the thing I am confused about with Nixon, but not so much, but you would think Trump would learn from this, a lot of Nixon's people went to jail while he was still president.
Yeah.
Now, he could have pardoned them. I would even think Haldeman and Ehrlichman, who were his boys, his buddies, I thought he would have pardoned them. Because you would think, because there's always this discussion on can Trump, will Trump fire Mueller? Well, if he really believes, he knows. I mean, you can lie to other people, but you can't lie to yourself. Trump knows what he did or did not know. And for him not to come out and pardon these people, which would be short of firing Mueller, if the Congress isn't going to do anything to him, why not do it and get out of this?
Yeah.
We know he will pardon Arpaio.
Yeah. I think if you pardon Manafort, well, the charges still don't go away. There's still some charges in the New York court. If he pardoned Manafort, I think public opinion would be so negative. I mean, what is this guy to him that he would pardon him? I think it would just be a difficult thing to justify. This is why he's not doing it. And he's basically said, oh, he only worked for me for 3 months. There are no good options here for this president, because this probe is going to continue, and I don't think he can short-circuit it, and any attempts that he makes to short-circuit it will just make him look more guilty. And he may not like to listen to advice, so I'm sure that's the advice he's getting.
My final question, and this is my understanding, and because I don't think this has ever happened, even if Trump decided to leave office on his own accord, or he decided, or he was impeached, either one, I think Pence would pardon him. I mean, I think he would, just out of loyalty, and I think that would happen, but it's my understanding that the charges in New York would still stand, because that the pardon would not cover it. Is it possible that for the first time a president could go to jail? Prison?
How about public service?
That would be
the irony of ironies. After Nixon, a lot of people, probably myself at the time also, thought, they really wanted to see him go to jail. But over time, I recognized that was the right decision that Ford made. And he was able to avoid jail time. But Trump's crimes, if they are of a financial nature, they could, and some of them no doubt predate his presidency. I don't necessarily think that the American people would want to see him go to jail, but they'd like to see some accountability, and I don't know what form that would take.
The most interesting thing I ever heard President Ford say in an interview, and it really doesn't get a whole lot of play, because they always ask him, was the fix in with the pardon? He said he offered the pardon to President Nixon. Nixon accepted it. And you can refuse a pardon, but the acceptance is the admission of guilt.
Right.
Because why would you need a pardon if you're innocent? I guess is the logic.
That's correct. Unless you're a true believer and you think, you're innocent and you've been railroaded and it's all been a hoax.
Which people will believe
now. Which is the line that Trump has peddled, right?
It's an interesting time, and I'm certainly glad the McLaughlin Group is back up and running. Because of things like this, what would John McLaughlin, in your opinion, be thinking about this? God bless him.
I don't think he'd be a Trump down the line supporter, and I think he'd be fascinated with all the legal ins and outs. I mean, he was very Jesuitical in his thinking. There was the sins of commission and the sins of omission, and he always made a distinction between them. So, yeah, I think we'd get a very Jesuitical read of the charges against Trump.
But he wouldn't
hang in there until the bitter end, like he did with Nixon.
Eleanor Clift, it's always fun to have you on. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that's all the time we have today for this day. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout. Stay tuned for more programming.
An exciting competition to our Marion youth.